Blog Talk Radio.
It's Kelly here at 620, and all right, I'm just looking over this religious freedom law and trying to figure out what exactly is going on in Indiana. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 is a federal law aimed at preventing laws that substantially burden a person's free exercise of religion. And it was held unconstitutional as applied to the states in the city of Bern versus Flores decision in 97, and ruled that the RFRA is not a proper exercise of Congress's enforcement powers, but it continues to be applied to the federal government. And a number of states have also passed a law to apply it to their state. So according to NBC News, that there are some people that are saying that it is different from the federal law. And so let's play a little another clip on this, and this is from ABC
that
News.
House, they've taken away stuff. You can see the neighborhood, though. It's a pretty tightly knit community.
By the way,
and
the NSA gate
together, and right now it is
the scene of a very bizarre event. Apparently, after a party,
crash a plane,
a couple of people went and tried to ram into the NSA gate. According to this story from Yahoo News,
we've seen almost no neighbors in the time that we've been here after the news broke.
If you're to believe this story, the
they didn't
know
too much with this media
circuit. Where they were
unlike
at.
Most areas,
but this is at Fort Meade in Maryland.
There's a lot of people hanging around.
NSA is one of the most heavily guarded portions of America.
Has come out to talk to the press.
One man is injured, the other is dead. The injured man was identified as Kevin Fleming, 20 years old, of Baltimore, and another man and he were in a stolen Ford Escape SUV, and they encountered NSA police at the entrance of the Fort Meade complex, and the attempted unauthorized entrance.
Pure Michigan for me is opportunity. Pure Michigan means that you can live, work, and play in one of the greatest places in the world.
Pure Michigan is a huge return on our investment.
And they accelerated for the NSA gate and refused to stop, and so police opened fire on the two men, and one was killed and the other was severely.
Many could argue that Yemen is already in a civil war,
but,
or at least on the
when I first saw that, I was kind of wondering if it was
a
terrorist attack,
two wars
or maybe it was somebody
other.
In the United
have
States.
The war
not,
the Houthi,
could have been
the Shiite rebels,
a Muslim
and
terrorist
the US
attack,
government.
But it could also be an American
and in the chaos, you have a
attack
second
against the NSA.
Hidden war between Al-Qaeda and ISIS,
and,
who are fighting to be the home address.
I've got
extremism
this
in Yemen,
story here
right
for you, but I got to get rid of some of these.
At the Arabian Peninsula, right next to Saudi Arabia, as Yemen.
Here is from the ABC News on the Religious Freedom Act. Trying to play this thing here, but anyway, let me. I need to close a few of these things, but. Anyway, what do you think about this act? What do you think about the idea that the state is giving its religious residents a right to express their beliefs? Even, I guess it could be, could come into play in the instance where somebody wanted, gay people wanted to be married and a minister was opposed to that, or they wanted to get a cake or flowers or whatever. And the business would say, you know, we don't believe in that. It happened in this state, and the Supreme Court ruled that they were guilty of prejudice.
Firestorm, where those games will take place, in Indiana, where the governor has signed a new religious freedom law. Protesters arguing that law now opens the door to discrimination against gays. On the other side, those who say it simply protects religious rights. In an ABC News exclusive, the governor digging in, saying this is about protecting everyone's beliefs. Our George Stephanopoulos asking the governor, should it be legal in Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians? You will see how he answered ABC's Gio Benitez in Indianapolis tonight.
Tonight, outrage on both sides of the debate over Indiana's new law. On one side, the desire to protect religious freedom. On the other, protesters who argue this paves the way for discrimination. More than a dozen other states have similar laws in place. But critics here worry Indiana does not have any state law preventing discrimination based on sexual orientation. And they argue the law could protect business owners who want to deny services to gay and lesbian customers. A wedding cake, for example. Tonight, an avalanche of criticism. Apple CEO Tim Cook calling the law dangerous. Angie's List putting a $40 million expansion project on hold. Even the NCAA calling it completely inconsistent with its values just days before the Final Four is held in Indiana.
We, the NCAA, have to sit down and say, all right, if this environment remains the way it is, what does that mean for us going forward?
George, look, we're not going to change the law.
George pressing the governor on this week, asking, will he change the law?
Do you think it should be legal in the state of Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians?
George,
it's a yes or no question.
Come on. Hoosiers don't believe in discrimination. It's about protecting liberty of every Hoosier of every faith.
Yes or no, should it be legal to discriminate against gays and lesbians?
George, you're following the mantra of the last week online, and you're trying to make this issue about something else.
Now tonight, Indiana's Speaker of the House saying a fix is on the way.
It's our intent to make crystal clear in the language that type of discrimination is not allowed.
The Speaker of the House telling me legislators hope to have that fix ready this week before the games are played here, David.
Gio Benitez tonight. Gio, thank you.
All right, folks. So what do you think about that? Do you, let me ask you this, 523-1450, do you think it is discrimination if a minister was to say to a gay couple, I'm not going to marry you, or a baker was to tell a gay couple, I would prefer not to make your cake? Do you think that is discrimination? Do you think it is an expression of freedom of religion and conviction? Do you think it's both? Do you think that it should be allowed? Should private businesses be allowed to decide who they're going to do business with? Or do you think that it is important that these different players out there be forced to interact with and meet the business needs of these individuals? I mean, this law doesn't say anything about gays, but some people might argue that it was that was the reason that it was put together. Here is Allison Krauss, 523-1450, Kelly O'Connell, 628, and we'll be right back on KOBE, The Kelly O'Connell Show. It is Kelly here, and I want to thank Rawson's Builder Supply for sponsoring the show. And I'm looking at a very strange story here. Mass exorcism of school kids leads many in hysterics as priest attempts to banish the devil. And this is in Gryfice, Poland, where the kids were attending a three-day help young people explore God and devote themselves to spiritual renewal through prayer camp. But instead of singing songs and praying, priest Thomas Wazerok, 37, was more interested in exorcising demons. And this did not go over too well with a lot of the parents, needless to say. And 1,000 young people were involved with this. And there's pictures on this page of kids laying on the ground as they get exercise, adults putting their hands over them. Very interesting story there. And, all right, so in other news, the Facebook illusions fool brain into thinking virtual reality is real. I don't think I've seen any of those. 30% of kids in Boston schools require English instruction. Half of students in some Colorado schools are from non-English speaking homes. So there's vast waves of immigrants that are washing across America, and you have to wonder what the impact of that is going to be in 10, 20, 50, 100 years. I wonder if the country could ever end up speaking Spanish as its main language. Half of older workers who were unemployed in the last 5 years are still unemployed, so that's tragic. McDonald's is starting table service. That's scary. I guess McDonald's is really fighting to get its core group back. A man decorating a family grave was killed by a falling headstone. That's pretty sad. And in Lackawanna County, that's pretty sad, isn't it? Trying to find out where Lackawanna County is here. Well, here's a little clip on that story. But that would be a pretty terrible way to go. All right. So so do you buy into this Religious Freedom Act, or do you think that it's time that we got rid of any vestiges of so-called prejudice and bias, these type of things? Or do you think that that is just kind of baked into the cake there in terms of, you know, how life is, that people are going to be prejudiced one way or the
other? Family grave for Easter this morning when the...
And that they've got every right to. Here's a little bit on this headstone that fell on this guy.
Right. Police tell us a man from Scranton and his wife were decorating a family grave for Easter this morning when the tombstone fell on top of the man, killing him. NewsWatch 16's Stacey Lang spoke with a man who tried to rescue the victim. She joins us live at the cemetery in Troop. Stacey.
Good evening, Sarah. The caretaker here at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Troop spoke with us shortly after that tragic incident this morning. The Lackawanna County coroner says it was 74-year-old Stephen Wojtek of Scranton who was killed here this morning when a headstone fell on top of him. The caretaker told us that Wojtek and his wife decorate the family grave for Easter every year. Ambulances and police cars swarmed a corner of St. Joseph's Cemetery on Sanderson Street in Troop, but once they got here, first responders were quiet and still. Cemetery caretaker Ed Kabilis was there in the scary moments before when a couple he sees every Easter season came to visit a family grave.
They tie a cross to it every year, the both of them. And after they're done tying the cross, they stand there, say prayers, and they leave. Well, I thought, and usually I come down and talk to them right away. I went up the other end to start picking up the Christmas ornaments, and he came running up. Help me, this stone fell on ceiling.
Troop police say 74-year-old Stephen Wojtek of Scranton was kneeling beside his mother-in-law's headstone, his wife on the other side, tying a cross on with string. The stone fell on Wojtek's body, killing him. Kabilis says each spring when the ground begins to thaw, some of the bases tilt and the stones on top can slip.
I guess so. So anyway, that's kind of tragic, huh? All right, so I'm kind of wondering, it doesn't seem like people really care about this Religious Freedom Act. I mean, the law's been around a long time. All right, it seems like there's a struggle between these two sides, and it's depending on how you define it. You know, you could say on the one hand it's prejudice, on the other hand you can say that it's religious freedom, but you know, if a person is expressing their religious freedom, do you consider that to be prejudice? Just curious. And so I've got a little bit here from, well, let's take in a little bit more, Allison Krauss, Kelly O'Connell. Got a little bit from Jeff Allen, the comedian, but I'll bring that up next time. 523-1450 to call in. 6:36 and on the KOBE Kelly O'Connell show.
She was someone I couldn't forget, and right and about my time.
All right, so they're saying that this pilot that had crashed was, when they went into his home, they found a mountain of antidepressants. And so I've looked at a large number of clips on this to try to bring you a little bit of, just a little bit of insight into these things. And I'm afraid I have too many clips, I can't remember what each one is, but here is how SSRIs and MAO inhibitors work, and this is from Relieve Depression.
Really good understanding of the monoamine oxidase theory and SSRIs. We need to go into your brain. Typically, of course, the space between the neurons, the synapse. Now, what you're looking at here are two neurons, and here's one here, the presynaptic neuron. And on the right, postsynaptic neuron. The signal will be coming through this neuron across the synapse and through this neuron. So it's in this synapse where all the action takes place and where we can affect your moods, your energy levels, etc. This is a perfect opportunity to also look at something, and that is the way that medications work to affect our moods. And let's just take depression as an example. Now, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to draw out these small yellow balls, which I'll refer to as molecules of serotonin. Now, let's assume that this neuron on the left here has...
I think this is a little bit hard to follow because he's kind of drawing stuff on the board, but it looks like just two green blobs, and he's putting these yellow dots in there, and these are that's the serotonin. The serotonin is blocked, and it stays around to keep people's moods up.
Today, I'd like,
it's obviously totally artificial, but the issue is that. That there are side effects, and some of them are extremely violent. So, you know, how there are so many different stories on here, and one of which was the sexual side effects of these drugs. So anywhere, let me just do this because I've got too much stuff to play here anyway. This is called A Brief History of SSRI Shootings. So these people come in. They get a diagnosis that they're depressed, and then some certain percentage, and undoubtedly a small percentage, but a meaningful amount of people then have violent reactions. So check this out. And this is from something called the Corbett Report.
In May 1998, 15-year-old Kip Kinkle murdered his parents and two classmates, as well as injuring 25 others, after engaging in a shooting spree that ended up in his school's cafeteria. In the investigation, it emerged that he had been taking popular antidepressant medication Prozac since the summer of the previous year. In December 2000, Michael McDermott went on a shooting rampage at his workplace, Edgewater Technologies, killing seven of his coworkers. During his trial, the court heard testimony that in the weeks before the shooting, McDermott had tripled the dosage of his antidepressant medication, Prozac, from 70 milligrams per day to 210 milligrams. In March 2005, 16-year-old Jeff Weiss shot and killed nine people, including five students at Red Lake Senior High School in Minnesota, before turning the gun on himself. It was later revealed he had been undergoing treatment for depression and had been on Prozac at the time. In September 2008, Finnish post-secondary student Matti Saari shot and killed 10 other students on campus before killing himself. The official Finnish government report on the incident revealed that he had been taking an SSRI medication at the time of the shooting. SSRI stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor, and it is a class of drugs that is often used to treat depression and anxiety. It includes Prozac, Zoloft, Celexa, Paxil, and a host of other commonly prescribed antidepressants. And the perpetrators of a raft of school shootings, mass murders, and other violent incidents in recent years have been taking them. And so it was perhaps not surprising when the culprit of this month's mass shooting at Fort Hood, specialist Ivan Lopez, turned out to be taking unnamed antidepressants himself.
We have very strong evidence that he had a medical history that indicates unstable psychiatric or psychological condition.
Lopez had been prescribed powerful antidepressants and the sleep drug Ambien. He was getting help. Dr. Javier Amador interviewed Major Nidal Hassan, who killed 13 people here at Fort Hood in 2009. Mental health issues, he says, must be aggressively treated, particularly when antidepressants are given.
You have to be very cautious and take care to be aware of which symptoms are improving more quickly than others. People's motivation comes back, their ability to sleep comes back, they feel more energy, but they're still feeling hopeless and suicidal.
Although it is yet to be reported, and may in fact never be revealed, precisely what type of antidepressant Lopez was taking or whether it was an SSRI, the number of confirmed SSRI shooters in recent years has raised the question of a causal link between the medication and incidents of violence. Although the drug manufacturers are quick to downplay this connection as anecdotal or coincidental.
Too often people like to assume, they project,
they make a little bit of logic, and they say, "Whoa, that could theoretically explain a large problem." That's faulty logic.
Boca Raton psychiatrist Abby Strauss says linking SSRI discontinuation to violence is oversimplistic.
Well, oversimplistic or not, it seems to be a real connection. They've got a chart that shows when these mood-enhancing drugs, the Paxil and such, were first released on the market, and just a clear connection between that date and when these school shootings started happening. Kelly O'Connell, 646, and got a little bit more Alison Krauss. I've got a really interesting clip from a psychiatrist I'll play for you related to this. 523-1450 to call in on KOBE. 31st of March. We'll be right back. It is Kelly here at 6:50. I want to get this stuff in for you to listen to. Consider if you know anybody on psychiatric medication, if you are on it yourself, consider some of these stories here. Here's a little bit more on the connection between the pills and shooting.
And he calls spreading the theory, quote, scary.
Mounting scientific evidence points to a strong correlation between the use of psychiatric drugs in general, and SSRIs in particular, and violent behavior. In 2010, the Public Library of Science published a study titled Prescription Drugs Associated with Reports of Violence Towards Others, which examined how 484 drugs were associated with 1,937 documented cases of violent behavior. Of those 484 drugs, 31 of them were responsible for 79% of the violence, including 11 antidepressants. When incidents of school massacres in the U.S. are charted against prescription of psychiatric medication, the correlation is undeniable. Further research is needed to establish...
Well, the line goes straight up, just to let you know. Now, here is something from Tom Sullivan on this. Psychiatric drugs, and American gun violence.
In Tucson, Arizona, Aurora, Colorado, Newtown, Connecticut, President Obama and gun control advocates called for a ban on assault weapons. But is it really the guns that are the problem? Mental health professionals have said that in all these cases, the shooters were on some kind of prescription medication. My next guest says it just might be the pills that are the problem. Joining me now, psychiatrist and author of Medication Madness, The Role of Psychiatric Drugs in Cases of Violence, Suicide, and Crime, Dr. Peter Breggin. And, Doctor, I love your message, and that's why I asked you to come on the show, because I think you have touched on something that is fascinating to me, is the fact that there are these psychotic drugs out there, and well, give the audience your opinion about them. I've heard you talk about this before.
Well, there's no doubt that psychiatric drugs can cause violence, and the...
This guy is a Harvard doctor and psychiatrist, by the way, so he comes out of the highest levels of the academy.
The most widely used ones, including particularly the antidepressants, the newer ones like Prozac and Paxil and Celexa, and also the benzodiazepines, the tranquilizers like Xanax and Klonopin, and then also the stimulant drugs we give to children. All of them have a significant association with violence. If you take a look at all the reports to the FDA about drug violence, all the drugs that we use, most of them, the vast majority, have no association with violence. And then those three groups I just mentioned, the psychiatric drugs, have many, many more times the number of reports of violence. So it's clearly established.
But you have somebody that comes to you and they are mentally ill. What do you do? Because a lot of doctors will just, you know, get out the old prescription pad and write a prescription. I've heard you talk about the fact that you've been doing this for decades and that you have cured a lot of mental illnesses with zero drugs.
Well, I don't think in terms of curing mental illnesses, Tom, as much as I think of helping people overcome their problems, helping people overcome their anguish, their pain, their anger, their suffering. And in my experience, and I think this is the absolute truth, what really helps people is a good, solid, caring relationship with somebody. And a therapist or psychiatrist, I'm a psychiatrist, who says, in effect, you can take charge of your life. You can be responsible for your life. You can learn how to handle your emotions. You can learn to live by better values. But that's not the current approach in psychiatry. You'll hear nothing in psychiatry about taking charge of your life, taking responsibility, or living by values. Instead, psychiatry turns people into machines and says, you have a biochemical imbalance, which is untrue. We've got a drug that can cure the biochemical imbalance, which is untrue. And those things make people feel more helpless and more out of control. So I think we need to get back to good, solid human relationship as a way of helping people.
Are you persona non grata at the Psychiatric Association meetings?
Well, I suppose I might even be subject to violence since we're talking about that. Yes, psychiatry is just a handmaiden now of the pharmaceutical industry. If you go to one of the big psychiatric meetings, it's going to a drug company carnival. They pay for everything. Psychiatry, our journals are paid for by the drug companies. Our meetings are paid for by the drug companies. And we make a lot of money by doing 10-minute med checks. You do a lot more financially that way than by sitting and talking with somebody. Psychiatry has lost its way. And I do think that the shootings really very much involve psychiatric drugs. I was an expert in cases surrounding Eric Harris from Columbine. I got to really look at his medical records, and you can see him deteriorating while taking an antidepressant, Luvox, and he had it in his bloodstream when he committed the violence.
Well, beyond the common thread of, you know, a lot of people say, well, these shootings, the guns have been the common thread. You're talking about, yeah, but there's also psychotic drugs are a common thread. I have a man I used to work with, sadly. I mean, father of the year, great guy, smart guy, but I didn't know he suffered from depression. They changed some medication on him. He went home and he stabbed to death his two little daughters. And he says to this day, he's in prison in North Carolina. He says it was because of the fact that the drugs made him do it. I never heard that argument before, but that seems to be yours.
Oh, well, there's no question about it. I've been involved in a case where a man on his second day of Paxil drowned his two children in a bathtub and drowned himself. There's a lot of cases like this. A woman who murdered one of her children and tried to murder another one on Zoloft. So this, which is an antidepressant. So there's no lack of cases about this. And I've looked at them in depth in Medication Madness, Tom. I have 50 cases where I've seen the medical records and interviewed people if they were alive, interviewed families where suicide and violence was a major theme.
Yeah.
So these are very serious problems.
Well, I'm just glad you're talking out about it. I'm glad you're speaking out about this. I wanted to give you the forum here to do.
Well, and it's kind of shocking, isn't it? I mean, it's the idea that you've got a bunch of things going on in society. We've got a certain number of people with a psychiatric or a psychological diagnosis. Some of them are just suffering from depression or anxiety. They're given these drugs. And I have a clip from a guy that said that he took a drug one time and it completely changed his life. And it changed his life in that when he woke up in the morning, he thought that he was going insane, that he had never felt like that before. And he felt like he was completely losing control. And he says that he's never been the same. And this is after one time of taking one of these drugs. So there's a lot of danger involved with that. I wanted to let you know that this pilot had a diagnosis. He had a mountain of pills in his house. He had been diagnosed as suicidal before. Now, obviously, he shouldn't have been flying the plane, but what impact? So we'll come back and talk about that a little bit more. Kelly O'Connell here to take you out with some Allison Krauss and Union Station, 523-1450 to call in at 659. We will be back after the break on the hour. It is Kelly here. Good morning to you. And, okay, so we were talking about SSRI, which are the serotonin replacement or inhibitor drugs that, without going into huge detail, these affect the chemistry in the brain and are supposed to keep some of the chemicals that make people happy or feel stable in the mix. And we've got some, there's a large number of stories that I've come across that in which the people say it's the exact opposite. And this Dr. Peter Bregan has got some wonderful stories on this. Now, here's a guy, and I'm linking this to the plane crash in the Alps. The guy who wrecked the plane, Lovitz, was care of four different psychiatrists in the last month, four different mental health people. They said he had a mountain of psychiatric medication in his apartment when they went in there, and that he had been suicidal in the past. So all of the elements are there to for this story to play out this way. Now, here's a gentleman who took one Lexapro, and he says it ruined his life.
Hello. This is my second video. It's about my experience with taking one 10 milligram pill of Lexapro and the symptoms and adverse reaction that occurred afterwards. I made another video, but after watching it, I realized I left out a lot of detailed information. So I wrote down a lot of the information so I could get it all into one video this time. I'm just going to read some of this from the paper that I wrote. The first thing that I wanted to say is why I took it. I took the Lexapro because I have had insomnia most of my life, and I was only getting about 4 hours sleep a night because I was working an overnight 12-hour shift. So I went to the doctor for insomnia, and he prescribed me a Lexapro. And I want to read what I wrote down about my experience because I have a hard time staying focused, and it's easy for me to get distracted. So anyway, I'm going to read this. This is what happened the next morning when I woke up after taking Lexapro. 8 hours later, I awoke to incredibly intense and horrible sensations I had never felt in my life. These sensations and strange physiological reactions were so intense that I thought I was going insane and knew immediately that I had poisoned myself by taking the Lexapro. I jumped out of bed and ran around my house and then ran out of the front door and down my street. Sometimes I had to leave the house and other times I couldn't be outside. My whole world was turned upside down that day. My life was forever changed. Looking back, it appears I had a severe adverse reaction to the Lexapro, which resulted in serotonin syndrome. I wrote that down because I can't stay focused like I used to. So it's a lot easier for me to write things down. Otherwise, I couldn't get the important information in this video. Anyway, I'll...
All right, so you get the feeling out of that one. Now, here is a little bit more about these psychiatric medications, and we're gonna switch off this topic, but I just wanted people to know that there is this small but growing body of work out there, or body of criticism towards the psychiatric medication. Claim is that they do not cure anything, any illnesses, in fact they really make things worse. And here's a little bit more from this Peter Bregman. Bregan, I wanted you to be thinking about this because there's a lot of individuals in this country on psychiatric medication. And, you know, at the least, you can say they're not dealing with what causes the symptoms. They're kind of masking it with these drugs. But in some cases, there does appear to be a violent reaction. Here's a little more Peter Bregan. And this clip is called Psychiatric Drugs Are More Dangerous Than You Ever Imagined. And like I said, this guy's a graduate of Harvard.
This is Dr. Peter Breggin, and this is another in my Simple Truths about psychiatry. And the subject today is that psychiatric drugs are much, much more dangerous than you've ever, ever been led to believe by the doctors who are prescribing them. I genuinely believe that if most people knew how dangerous the psychiatric drugs really were, most people would never start on them. And I also believe that if most prescribers had even the faintest idea how dangerous they were, they'd stop prescribing them. Well, how is it that so many people can be ignorant about psychiatric drugs? Well, the truth is because they're all getting their information from the drug companies. I mean, when was the last time you saw a car company leap up to tell people way in advance that they'd had some deaths on the road from their bad brakes? When was the last time a car companies went mea culpa and said, yes, our accelerators are sticking and running people down? Well, I can tell you the drug companies are even worse. They go to all kinds of extremes to avoid letting you know and letting your doctor know how dangerous the drugs are. I know this because I've been a medical expert in dozens of lawsuits against drug companies. I've looked inside drug companies and seen what they're really doing. I was appointed by a court in Indiana to be the scientific expert for over 150 lawsuits against Eli Lilly, suits alleging that the drug Prozac had caused violence, suicide, mayhem, mania, and psychosis. So I know what goes inside. I know as much as anyone about how dangerous the drugs are. So let me just give you a little brief outline of material you can find in the first half of my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. Obviously, the second half is intended to help you come off psychiatric drugs because it can be very dangerous to come off drugs. It's dangerous and sometimes more than starting the drugs. Let's take a look at the stimulants that you may be taking as a college student or as a parent that you may be giving to your children. Follow-up studies on people who were started on stimulants as children show that they have shrinkage of brain tissue, measurable on brain scans. They have reduced height and weight. They're being incarcerated more often than other people. They're going to mental hospitals more often. Their suicide rate has increased. Every single one of these facts documented by follow-up studies of what happens to you if you get started on stimulants. And one particularly well-done study, the rate of cocaine abuse is greater when you become a young man or woman if you've been put on stimulants as a child. That's because the stimulant drugs such as Ritalin and Concerta and Adderall and Dexedrine, they're so similar to cocaine in their effects. All right, let's look at another group, the sedative sleeping pills that you're taking, like Sonata and Ambien, any one of the prescription sedatives used for sleep. We now got two or more good studies showing they shorten lifespan. You can Google them. You can Google practically anything I'm telling you, but you'll get more accurate direct data from psychiatric drug withdrawal. Now, what about the benzodiazepines, the tranquilizers like Xanax and Valium and Ativan and Klonopin? They're very addictive. You know that people taking Xanax in controlled clinical trials, after a mere 6 weeks, a large percentage can't get off. After a mere 6 weeks, they become addicts to Xanax. Great for the drug business. Great for your psychiatrist or prescriber who just wants to write prescriptions. Terrible for you. These drugs now, several studies show, like Xanax and Ativan, they're causing shrinkage of the brain too. Coming off them can be an absolute horror story. It can be harder to get off those drugs than to get off opiates. They leave people who try to come off of them with horrendous insomnia, horrendous anxiety, aches and pains in their body, such pain in their feet that they can't stand up, that it's just too much pain, weird feelings throughout their body. And then the realization as they come off that their minds aren't working as well, but they have memory loss for the past and have more trouble learning. Now, I know this is hard. You know, it's hard for me to even talk about it, but it's really time to face up to just how dangerous these drugs are. So we've looked at the stimulants and the sleeping pills.
All right, so that just gives you a kind of an overview. You've got a lot of drugs out there that are being used on people, and they are, some people don't have any of these adverse effects, but the ones that do, you know, some certain small percentage of these people have violent tendencies that have been connected to these drugs. And, you know, so why is it, if the psychiatric theories that we're using are correct, why is it that all of these shooters and all of these, mass killers seem to be under a psychiatrist's care and on these medications if they work? And how is it that this pilot was under all this medication and under the care of a psychiatrist, and he went up and he killed all those people? It wasn't just a suicide. He was a mass murderer. For what? For why? And it's related to these drugs from what I can tell. Anyway, Kelly O'Connell, 718, we're being sponsored by 23-1450 to call in. Not getting a lot of calls on this, so I think we'll switch gears, and we'll be right back.
Charles, look, you were referring to this latest cave, the bait and switch.
Click now to cruise home in a stylish new 2015 Toyota Corolla from Vescovo Toyota.
Kelly here, and I'm looking at this story about Iran and what is going on there. And it's really hard to try to figure out what is really happening. You've got one side, you've got the American people that are apparently 60% of the American people are in favor of this deal, but at the same time, they're saying something equally is obvious, that if we can't hold Iran to this deal, then there's no point in it. On the other hand, there's people that say that the president is selling the United States out, that it's a terrible deal, that it's a one-sided, that he's just sent his people in there to support Iran in this thing. So story that I'm getting out of this is that Iran is being held up as the centerpiece or one of the pillars of the Middle East. And with this idea that, you know, we've got to put our faith in them and we've got to make this deal with them, and as opposed to just stopping them from making a bomb. But anyway, here's from Reuters, Iran nuclear talks in final stretch.
The foreign ministers of Iran and six world powers are fast approaching the deadline for an agreement aimed at finally ending Tehran's nuclear standoff with the West. The ministers have been in marathon negotiations in Lausanne, Switzerland to reach a deal. But according to observers, three major sticking points still have to be resolved. Among them, the duration of any limits on Iran's nuclear activities after an initial 10 years. Also, the possible restoration of sanctions against Tehran in the event Iran fails to comply with the deal terms. Without answers to these questions, diplomats say, there cannot be an agreement. Even if the parties reach an agreement on Tuesday, officials close to the talks say it could still fall apart. The two sides still have to agree on all of the technical details for a comprehensive final accord by June 30th.
All right, and now we have a little bit of something from Charles Krauthammer on this deal.
Charles, look, you were referring to this latest case.
Rebels in Idlib in northwest Syria purportedly freeing prisoners from a state-run jail on Sunday.
Here is this statement from Charles Krauthammer.
Charles, look, you were referring to this latest cave, the bait and switch in which we'd been assured that Iran would have to get rid of exports into another country, its highly enriched uranium. And now we were hearing, that's the bombshell that we saw in the Times yesterday, is that, well, we're looking at other ways it could stay inside of Iran, but it'll be changing, it'll be diluted. Well, that means to making it into an oxide. Yes, you make it into an oxide, you can't use it in a bomb, but you can reverse the process in 2 weeks. This is part of the farcical excuses that a desperate administration is making in order to explain one cave after another. Another cave was the requirement that the IAEA, the inspectors, international inspectors, have to be told what Iran had worked on in the past. Because unless you know what it did in the past, what might be hidden, what facilities exist, what material is produced, you have no way of having a regime where you're going to know what they're hiding in the future. And we, what we're hearing now is we have now agreed to put it off until after sanctions are lifted. If the Iranians aren't going to disclose the past activities under huge sanctions, they are certainly not going to do it when sanctions are lifted. It is one red line after another abandoned. And that's why the Gulf Arabs are scared to death about what the consequences of this agreement is going to be.
And what about this?
All right, so there's some skepticism, and here's a little bit from Senator Graham.
Welcome to DEFCON 3. I'm Katie McFarland. Iranian negotiators reportedly made a last-ditch push for more concessions from the United States and five other world powers as the talks on the fate of Iran's nuclear program come down to the final hours before the crucial deadline. Critics say this is the latest example of why Washington can't trust Tehran. Here with reaction is South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Thank you so much for joining us, Senator.
Thank you.
All these last-minute concessions, is the United States making concessions?
Well, there's a guy who defected in Switzerland who was an Iranian journalist, if there is such a thing. And he defected in the last couple of days. He said that he couldn't write anything about the nuclear talks or anything in Iran without censorship being used by the Ayatollahs. He got frustrated. He was a Rouhani guy, the president of Iran. He was one of his associates. And he said as a throwaway line, oh, by the way, the Americans have adopted the Iranian position, trying to convince the Europeans that what Iran wants is reasonable. So not only are we in the 11th hour where they're making more demands, we've got people on the American side who brought you North Korea doing the negotiating. And we got people on the American side who want a deal so bad they can't stand it. We got people on the American side who are negotiating with the Iranians as they're destabilizing the entire Mideast without even bringing it up. We've got a president who doesn't, who brought you the Mideast as it is today. We've got people on the American side who are completely clueless as to the threats we face throughout the region and what a bad deal would do.
What do you think at this point, then, we should just walk away from the deal? The president keeps saying
now,
it's either this deal or war.
There's no way. Let's see. Okay, here's my retort to that. Mr. President, a bad deal leads to a nuclear arms race and a nuclear war. If you get a bad deal, if you give these guys 6,000 centrifuges, if you allow an R&D program that could be spun up to make a weapon in 90 days, if you do a deal where the Arabs feel like they're a threshold nation in Iran regarding a nuclear capability, the Arabs are going to want to bomb themselves. So a bad deal, Mr. President, leads to a nuclear arms race in the Mideast. It puts Israel in an untenable position. A good deal would allow them to have a nuclear power program that can't be used to make a bomb.
So the question is, of course, does Obama want Iran to have a bomb, or does he care if they have a bomb? And I'm the reason I'm asking this is because I really don't know. I mean, maybe Obama feels like if the Iranians don't have, they will never stop until they get a nuclear bomb, so you might as well let them have it. Maybe he feels like they need the bomb to defend themselves. And it is seems that he feels it's absolutely crucial that the Iranians be a part of the any future negotiations for the power structure in the Middle East. I don't know where the president gets his ideas from on Iran. It just seems like it's kind of happening in a way that's dismaying. 523-1450 to call in, 729 on the button. And here's a little more Alison Krauss for you.
It's amazing how you can speak right to my heart. Without saying a word, you can light up the dark.
It is Kelly here, and good morning to you. Looking for local stories. And according to labor officials, New Mexico and West Texas workers are underpaid. Those would be oil workers, of course. And violations of the Fair Labor Standards have resulted in hundreds of oil field workers in New Mexico and West Texas being underpaid by more than $1.3 million, according to federal officials. And the most violations involve improper payments of overtime, and sometimes the employees didn't receive overtime premiums because they were misclassified, and there were also instances of employees not paying for time spent working off the clock. And it is a study that was launched by the division last year in the Southwest. So there's a lot of work out there, but I guess you got to be a little bit careful in how you're paid. Here's a little bit on the Chimayo pilgrimage from KRQE.
Pilgrims are getting ready for the annual trek to El Santuario de Chimayo, and the New Mexico Department of Transportation is working to keep people safe for the Holy Week tradition. News 13's Aaron Drawhorn is in the Newsplex with what you need to know. Aaron?
Dean, while pilgrims show their faith, their sacrifice, drivers will need to show some care and some caution, all within miles of Chimayo. Let's start here with the maps. US 84, 285, as it's known as well, will have lanes closed. This is going to be just north of Santa Fe, and that's going to be starting on Thursday and on Good Friday. You also want to exercise some caution on the other main routes. That would be a 502, also 503. And, of course, Highway 76, that's the main road to Chimayo, it will be most crowded. Pilgrims are expected to make that walk to the Roman Catholic Shrine in northern New Mexico. The faithful believe the church has holy soil each Easter season. For 200 years, worshipers have made the journey in one way or the other, walking to the Adobe Church, many of them collecting healing dirt. The worship.
Well,
solid news.
Do you believe in healing dirt? I'm not sure about that myself, but here's a little bit of Jeff Allen. I Need Some Space. Check this out. A little comedy for you.
A kid comes to me about a year ago. This is what he says to me about a year ago. He goes, listen, I'm not making this up. He goes, I need some space. Place is cramped. I need some space. So I remember what my father did when I told him I needed some space. He walked me to the front door, opened it up, and said, a lot of space out there, boy. If I remember right, he had one foot on my backside ready to launch me into the world. So my son had it figured out in the basement. He had a room all planned out. We didn't have a room down there. And he said, if you build a room here, you can put a bathroom off of here, and this is great. And I'm thinking, that's enterprising, and I agreed with him. But I said, as long as you understand, if I build this room, this is still my house. My house. He goes, oh, yeah. Building the room. It's beautiful down there, man. He's gonna be, and I'm walking by 6 weeks after the room, and I hear him on the phone with one of his buddies. Finally got my own place. I tell my wife, I said, he has no intention of ever leaving our home. He thinks he's got a condo down there. She says, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to freeze him out. That's what I'm going to do. I figured come winter, I'll just close the vents. He'll never figure it out. Sure enough, one day he comes upstairs, got an electric blanket wrapped around him with an orange extension cord, 100 feet of it. Hey, what's with the heat? I don't know. Talk to your homeowners association condo boy.
And if you do nothing with your children all week, eat dinner with them, for gosh sakes. The things that come out of their mouth. We're eating dinner one night, my 15-year-old goes, hey, I just thought of this. I go, what is it? He goes, I'll be driving. And if you...
To get a really...
I wrote that.
I'm Peter R. Bregan, M.D., and I am a psychiatrist. And the subject today is the suicidally depressed person. And it is number 5 in my series of simple truths about psychiatry. In some of the earlier presentations, I talked a lot about the problems with using drugs, and I'm going to talk more about that in more detail in later presentations. Hi, I'm Peter Bregan.
Hi, it's Kelly here. It is 7:38, and just looking at some of your other headlines here, there's a lot about Iran. They're wanting to use, they're testing Amazon drones for delivery. And I wonder how much range these things would have. I mean, obviously, you're not going to get a drone to fly across the country to deliver a book, you know. So I'm assuming it would be flown out of the local area. It would have to be. But it kind of makes you wonder, why can't they just, if they've mailed it to the local area, why they can't finish it. All right, still a lot of turmoil in the Hillary Clinton camp, that she used multiple devices for email, and that she has not cooperated supposedly on these requests for information about Benghazi, et cetera. They say illegals are souring on Obama and the Democrats for some strange reason. Report says world to run out of mineable gold in 20 years. We've heard so many stories like that over the ages, so kind of wonder about that. I don't know why they say that. and Prince Charles.
Energy is momentum. It moves us forward, carries us into the future. But how that future looks will be shaped by what we do with that energy today. For 40 years, our country hasn't been able to export crude oil. This ban is about the past, not the future. At ConocoPhillips, we believe that allowing exports could support jobs and economic growth here at home while helping to meet global energy demand. That's the power of energy. Come see how we're putting power in cooperation.
If all of the masses will follow along, you can save the planet and still leave a little bit of global warming for their own travel needs or the house or whatever. Thousands of smart meters on
President Obama's immigration policies faltered in the courts, took on fire on Capitol Hill, and even angered his political base this past week.
Of smart meters
his
on,
own deportation
on homes
also undercut his message, and now the president
the
is struggling
pole.
To find a middle
Isn't
ground path. Alex Swear, The Washington Times.
And, all right, so here is looking for any local stories. They say don't give chicks and bunnies for Easter. Donna County Irrigation District.
Energy is momentum. It moves us forward, carries us into the future. But how that future looks will be shaped by what we do with that energy today. For 40 years, our country hasn't been able to export crude oil. This ban is about the past, not the future. At ConocoPhillips, we believe that allowing exports could support jobs and economic growth here at home while helping to meet global energy demand. That's the power of energy. Come see how we're putting power in cooperation.
Seeing as how she's a former prosecutor. All right, I just got a text. I wanted to put another track on here from Peter Bregan, because, you know, I'm sure if you're listening to this and you're thinking I'm depressed or somebody in my family's depressed, my friend, they went to the doctor. Now the doctor has prescribed them this medication that you're saying is so bad. What can I do? I want to play, because I haven't been getting any calls, 523-1450 about this, but this guy is so brilliant and his points are so well stated. I want to put on what he says is the answer to these psychiatric dilemmas. I thought part of this was one of the most interesting things I've ever heard about the mentally ill. How to help the suicidally depressed person. Actually, this clip right here is Simple Truths About Psychiatry, How to Help Deeply Disturbed Persons. Check this out.
Hi, I'm Peter Bregan, Peter R. Bregan, MD. I'm a psychiatrist. This is the fourth in my series of Simple Truths About Psychiatry. And the topic today is going to be the patient who is psychotic and gets labeled schizophrenic, and what would really most effectively help that individual. The first three presentations in this series have been about the limits of psychiatric drugs and how they are harmful to the brain. And I think it's time to take a little break from that and look at how do we help, without using drugs, some of the most very upset people. And then my next presentation, following this one, will be on helping the person who's so depressed that he or she is suicidal. So we'll just really confront these issues directly. I got started in psychiatry when I was 18 years old. I was a freshman at Harvard College, planning to go on and probably major, well, I was majoring in American history and literature and thinking maybe I'd be a professor in the future years. And a friend of mine invited me to volunteer at Metropolitan State Hospital. It was 1954. We went out to the hospital, which sat, as so many of them knew, like a medieval fortress on the top of a hill outside of a town. And when we entered the hospital, my immediate impression from the stench, from the dilapidated conditions, from the bent over and humiliated patients, was my Uncle Dutch's descriptions of liberating an extermination camp toward the end of World War II. It profoundly affected me. Now, I don't know why, but spontaneously, I felt that if I had been in those conditions, living like that, confined, like abused and deprived and lonely, that I wouldn't be able to keep my sanity. And as I would visit with the patients, and I can't exactly tell you why, I never had a sense that, oh, you're different from me, you're defective, I'm not. I always had a sense of, there, but for the grace of God, go I. That this could happen to anyone. That life could break anyone emotionally, was my sense of it. And certainly I thought at that time, at the age of 18, that I was not invulnerable. Well, I ended up leading this program, even wrote a book about it, my first book, and lecturing about the program. So I got really involved as just a young boy, really, in this whole field of mental health. And I went to the superintendent and I said that, you know, we've got like a dozen of us and we want to do more than just visit with the patients and take them on trips and clean the wards and have parties and stuff. We think that it would be really helpful if each of us had our own patient that we visited every week during the school year. And we have this lovely social worker who's willing to supervise us and that won't take but an hour or two of his time a week to supervise us. Principal. It's an interesting slip because it's a bit like being in school, I guess, only the worst parts of school. The superintendent of the hospital got mad at me about this. But eventually he realized that if we left his hospital and went to another hospital, that we were actually the best thing that had happened in a long time. We were already getting good publicity for the hospital. So he gave a group of us, about 12, as I recall, each our own patient that we could work with. And they gave us patients who were so bad off that they thought we couldn't hurt them, patients they expected to spend the rest of their lives in the hospital. And I described this scene of the hospital and the outcome in the opening chapter of Toxic Psychiatry. We got all but three of the patients out of the hospital. And over a follow-up period, only two or three came back. So I learned right away that the psychiatric treatments were doing more harm than good. And in the case of the state mental hospital, horribly more harm than good. And that the answer to helping even the most disturbed human being under the worst possible conditions was human relationship.
That is pretty interesting, huh? Okay, so let me come back to a little bit more on that. I hope you don't mind that I'm playing this guy, because I thought that, number one, he's a huge advocate. He's very prominent advocate for using non-drug therapy for mentally ill people, which might sound totally crazy, for lack of a better word, and yet we see so much damage by these psychiatric medications that it's worth thinking about. Another thing that he does is he's got a kind of a human approach to the whole thing. You're not dropping people off in psych hospitals where they're cared for by people that they don't know and are under drug regimens and have to deal with other mentally ill people. So anyway, here is a little more Alison Krauss for you, and we'll be right back after a break.
Try as I may, I could never explain what I hear when you don't say a thing. Thank you.
It is Kelly here, and here's just a little bit more of this clip from this guy, Peter R. Bregin, M.D., B-R-E-G-G-I-N. He's on YouTube, and he's also been involved in a lot of court cases, and he's about, I think, about 80 years old now, 78 years old. Here's a little bit more on helping people, the most deeply disturbed persons.
And again, I can't tell you exactly why, but from the start, it looked to me like it was about love. It was about people caring for each other. So back in the 50s, I was already writing about love as healing. I hadn't yet read Buber's I and Thou and other sophisticated books about this idea. And that's why I went into psychiatry. But psychiatry was changing because at the same time, the drugs came in. Thorazine, the first of the really heavy lobotomizing drugs. And psychiatry moved so strongly in the drug direction that there was no room. By the time I graduated from medical school and started in psychiatry, there's no room anymore for psychological or social psychiatry because we were on the way to the psychiatry of today, which is I'll diagnose you and drug you and send you home, and maybe a social worker will talk to you along the way, maybe. Excuse me. So by the time I finished and went into private practice, I knew that psychiatry had gone in one direction and I was going in a psychological and social direction for helping people. Now, let's look at the most serious kind of a problem. The person who becomes really, really crazy. Let's say it's a 16-year-old girl and abruptly, after a period of shyness usually and a feeling somewhat withdrawn and being a little maybe different than other kids, the young woman begins to hallucinate. She begins to hear voices blaming her for things, voices persecuting her, voices talking mean to her. She begins to think that she's somebody who's very special and is somehow the center of a great deal of activity by other people. That people are maybe conspiring against her. Her mother and father are working with the CIA or with some other organization. If she gets disturbed enough, at some point she might think that maybe she saw for a minute that her father had a tail or that her mother had horns. And she's frightened out of her mind. Well, what's going on here? It's not as complicated as it may seem. What's going on is that the social connections, the social fabric of this person's life has begun to tear apart. When people are functioning normally, we're very creative. We can do all kinds of varieties of things and people look really different. But when people are breaking down, you get a lower common denominator and things begin to look more similar from person to person. And so the person who is psychotic has hallucinations or delusions, and their thoughts can be very strange and not make any sense. And they're also helpless. And they usually, in the case of somebody who's going to end up with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, I don't use those diagnoses, but they're there. That person's been shy and withdrawn, and you see a process taking place. The process is one of no longer trusting people. So where do you go when you're so frightened and usually so ashamed of yourself? Usually a lot of shame about you. What do you do? So ashamed of yourself and yourself.
Well, did you know certain cartoon characters should never have an energy drink?
Let me see. We got a little bit of a lead over here, but I hope you're enjoying this the way that I did when I heard it. Here's a little bit more Peter Bregin.
So frightened. that you don't believe anybody could care for you. You don't believe anybody could trust you. You don't trust anybody. Where do you go? Well, if you're the sort of creative, imaginative person who's going to get labeled schizophrenic, you go into what looks like very bad metaphors, broken poetry, and nightmarish, literally nightmares kinds of experiences. And rarely are they comforting. The breakdown is not comforting. So what is the beginning of recovery for this person? It's not very complicated. It's the building of a trusting relationship with someone. And hopefully, if the parents are responsible and are willing to participate, healing the broken social threads of the family. That's the answer. That's the answer. Without even worrying about why one person becomes very disturbed and another doesn't, and how much is the mother to blame or the parents to blame, and why does the social fabric unravel? Without even worrying about that, we do know what heals, and the family heals. And a caring therapy relationship can heal.
All right, so running out of time here, but I thought it was pretty interesting. I mean, let's be honest here. We know that these medications don't really cure people. They mask the symptoms. And yet we approach this as if it were the cure. And so looking at the plane wreck in the Alps where this guy does a suicide mission with 150 people on board, I mean, was that avoidable? I mean, obviously it was avoidable, but what kind of treatment did he get? What were his symptoms? How much medication was he on when he was suicidal? How did he express that, and what response did they give him? All of these questions come to mind, and it's sad. He seemed like he was, I don't know, he was trying to contribute to society, but he got this idea in his mind that he was losing his dream, and he wanted to go out with a big bang, and he did literally. But anyway, the show is on Blog Talk Radio if you want.